This is Anthony Stevens, May 22nd, 1985. War and Peace.
Do you want me to put that on? Where do I do it? Oh, I see, like that. Yeah. Warfare has its roots deep in the collective unconscious of mankind. And I'm being deliberately sexist when I use the term mankind, because war is not a feminine problem, except, of course, indirectly. It's a masculine problem. Women do not make war, men do. Now, history, both ancient and modern, demonstrates an apparently inexorable alternation between periods of war and periods of peace, and that these two phenomena should alternate in so regularly cyclical a fashion points to some very profound archetypal process at work. The yang of war and the yin of peace are the expressions of fundamental forces which seem to be inexorable. War and peace I take as being at opposing ends of a continuum. They are really two aspects of the same thing, namely relations between two or more groups of people. War, you see, is really inconceivable without peace, and peace is inconceivable without war. But they're not absolute concepts. They taper into one another. They're relative. I mean, for example, the Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland haven't declared war on one another in the last 15 years, but Northern Ireland hasn't been a particularly peaceful place to live in during that time. As one Belfast citizen once put it to me, he said, "Anyone who isn't confused here doesn't really understand what's going on." Well, that war has an archetypal basis is supported by evidence from a vast variety of sources, from biology, from comparative anthropology, from mythology, religion, history, literature, current events, and cosmology too. And I believe that the archetypal concept is absolutely indispensable if we are to understand really why wars occur. It's no use, I believe, looking to politics or economics or sociology or experimental psychology or history to find explanations of war, why it is the fundamental causes of conflict between groups of human beings, why they occur. The origins of conflict, I'm sure, lie very much deeper than secondary historical considerations. These are but rationalizations of imperatives which come from a very much deeper, profounder realm of experience. In other words, really what I'm saying is that the origins of conflict have very little to do with reason, but are rooted in the biology of our species. When you come to think about human behavior, you don't have to be a Nobel laureate to realize that there is one fundamental determinant that we all have in common, and that's the human brain. Could we put the thing on? We know a lot more about the brain now, thanks to recent researchers, particularly Paul McLean, who's drawn our attention to the fact that the human brain is a developmental modification of the mammalian and reptilian brains, which are still to some extent intact and functioning within the midbrain and brainstem of our own brains. We also know that what McLean calls the paleomammalian brain contains the limbic system, and also which includes the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. Now, in this region, there are nuclei called the amygdala nuclei. And it's found that if you stimulate these electrically with tiny, tiny electrodes, in animals you get a rage response. They behave in a most aggressive and violent way. You can also get curious states of consciousness in human beings if you stimulate these regions, in which people report feeling extremely angry and desires to behave in a violent and aggressive way. We also know a lot more about the endocrinology of aggression. We know that changes occur in the hormones in the blood when human beings and experimental animals are in the rage state. Particularly the male hormone, testosterone, goes up, and also the hormones are secreted by the medulla of the adrenal gland. We also know that appeasement and submissive behavior and fear behavior coincides with rise in the levels of hormones which come from the adrenal cortex. So, you see, there can't be much doubt that we have been endowed by natural selection with mechanisms in the brain and in the body which are responsible for both the expression and the inhibition of aggressive behavior. Now, this fact gives rise to one fundamentally important question. If our capacity for aggressive conflict is biologically determined, then what useful function does it perform? I mean, why has nature seen fit to equip us in this way? What are, in other words, the selective biological advantages of being the aggressive, potentially violent creatures that men are? Well, there are a group of biologists who, for the last 30 years, have been studying the behavior of animals in the wild. And this group of biologists are known as ethologists. And the most famous of them are Conrad Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen and a man called Ibel Ibersfeld, some of whom I'm sure you will have heard about. And they have concluded that aggression and sexuality both contribute to the survival of each species by performing a number of vital functions. And we can summarize these functions in this chart. In the first place, aggression has been primarily responsible for spreading populations out over the habitat available to them so that they can use up as wide an area as possible. And this permits access to valued resources such as territory, water, food, and females in estrus. I'm talking about animals, incidentally. One of the most extraordinary achievements of our species, though, is the way in which we have succeeded in spreading out all over the planet and colonizing even the most inhospitable parts of it. And this is due, in very large measure, not just to our adaptability, but also to the primordial willingness of human communities to attack one another. And this goes back thousands and thousands of years. Secondly, aggressive behavior is associated with dominance driving and social assertiveness, and it results in the emergence of leaders within each group. And their function seems to be universally to ensure group cohesion and to take strategic decisions and maintain discipline within the group. And then finally, from the purely biological standpoint, one of the most important consequences of aggressiveness is that it promotes what the biologists call differential reproduction. That's to say that it's the fittest, the more aggressive and the more dominant males who have the pick of the most desirable females and who thus sire the next generation, passing on genes which are selectively advantageous for the continued survival of the population. Now, this is the basis of the archetypal union of Mars with Venus. Here you see Mars, the god of war, consorting with Venus, the goddess of love, in Botticelli's famous painting. Mars, in the language of the 60s, is about to make love, not war. Although by the look of him, he looks as if he's already made it. That phrase, incidentally, to make love, not war, still sticks in the mind because it pithily sums up the dual nature of our species. We are, you see, swayed by opposing passions, the passion for attachment and the passion for conflict once our blood is up. But it's not feasible to replace one entirely with the other. Unfortunately, men are like Mars. They want to make love and war. Now, I realize that in arguing that our capacity for aggression is an essential part of our biological equipment, like hunger, thirst, and sex, I'm advancing a view at odds with the old and still very influential behaviorist belief that aggressive behavior is learned and occurs when it does occur purely as a response to frustration. And I also realize that if what I say is true, then it cuts the ground from beneath the feet of social theorists who maintain that war can be abolished from human affairs by changing the world's social institutions and practices in such a way as to minimize frustration. Now, I also know that there are people who still believe that warfare and social life and the arts began in Mesopotamia a few thousand years ago. But I'm afraid they're rather like Archbishop Usher, who believed that the world began in 4004 BC. Because the anthropological study of Stone Age people demonstrates the absurdity of the notion that armed conflict is something new. Careful observations, you see, not only of extant Stone Age peoples, but also of primate behavior, chimpanzees, rhesus monkeys, and baboons, shows how very ancient social organization for cooperation, aggression, and defense are. I want to show you just a video. I hope you'll be able to see it and hear it. It's from Jane Goodall's film about the Gombe Reserve chimpanzees. And I want you to see in this, it's marvelous, how she shows the social organization, the bonding, the love, the tenderness which chimpanzees show, but also the aggressiveness and the way in which they use weapons. You know, many of these social theorists say man learned to use weapons very late in his evolution. It's clearly rubbish. I mean, you'll see chimpanzees using weapons in this way.
Adult males dominate chimp society, and when, as here, two groups meet, males may reaffirm their rank with a spectacular charging display. With hair bristling and vegetation flying, the male makes himself appear larger and more dangerous than he actually is. But the display is usually nothing more than bluff. This infant male already has the idea, but not yet the coordination. After displays of aggression, the dominant chimp often reassures those who have been frightened or hurt, and thus tension is diffused, social harmony restored. But the scheme is not without its flaws. The bananas attracted baboons too. David Greybeard repeatedly ran to his friend, the more powerful Goliath, for protection. Goliath came to David's defense, but the baboon seemed to know which chimp was afraid, and it was David. But they do sometimes compete for food, and friction can arise. Because he has the intelligence to use a weapon, yet another type of tool, even this young chimp can intimidate a fully grown baboon. But the relationship is sometimes more violent. A young baboon has been caught and killed by a group of chimps, and they will feast on its remains. Chimpanzees are not always the gentle vegetarians we thought, but can, like humans, be formidable predators. Sometimes cooperating to hunt and stalk their prey, they also kill young bushbuck, pigs, and monkeys. For the most part, chimps eat meat only they themselves have killed. Indeed, a dead animal is often a puzzling sight. In recent years, they and Jane witnessed a startling turn of events. Like Gombe itself, the chimps, it seemed, had changed too.
If I dressed as Lewis Leakey predicted after 10 years, we would have had a very different picture of the chimpanzees to that which we have today. People's idea of the gentle, noble savage would have been exemplified by the way of life of the chimps. I started off studying one community, and in 1972 that community divided into two. And one part of it moved down into the south of the range that the whole community had shared. 2 years later, a series of events began which were amongst the most horrifying that we've seen at Gombe. The males of the larger Kasekela community, the ones that we're studying today, systematically began to hunt down individuals of the smaller southern community, to attack them when they found them on their own or in small groups. And within a 4-year period, every one of the 7 males and at least one of the 3 females who had moved to the south had disappeared. The sequence of events that occurred during this warfare were really shocking, because these attacks were not over in 1 minute. They lasted 20 minutes. They were gang attacks where between 3 and 6 adult males together attacked one victim. The victim was rendered senseless, virtually crouching on the ground, not even trying to fight back. And yet they would pound him, they would drag him, they would bite him, they would smash him. One of them had a broken leg, one of them had a great piece of skin ripped from his thigh. And these were very, very brutal.
Well, existing monkeys and apes are not our direct ancestors, it's true, but their social behavior, as you can see, is so rich in parallels to our own that it requires the dedicated blindness of the behaviourists not to see that they share common evolutionary origins. And it does strike me as somewhat inverted arrogance to assume that the social organisation of our hominid ancestors was inferior to that of chimpanzees and baboons. But it's often argued still by sociologists that modern warfare has nothing whatever to do with aggression. They maintain, for example, that an airman flying a bomber to attack a city or a soldier arming an intercontinental ballistic missile is not behaving aggressively, but technologically. As Ruth Harriet Jacobs puts it, the people who kill with modern technology don't even see their enemy and are not exhibiting aggression at all. They're exhibiting obedience. Well, this is, on the face of it, a pretty persuasive argument. I mean, one's got to acknowledge that modern warfare is not nearly as satisfactory a vehicle for outgroup hostility as its Paleolithic equivalent. Modern war is dreadfully expensive and difficult to organise. It requires elaborate training, and the enemy is indeed anonymous and often remote. It's perfectly true that aggressive feelings achieve their most satisfactory discharge when expressed against relatively close and recognisable opponents. I mean, if you punch me on the nose or insult my father's memory, I want to do something about it here and now. But if I have to serve a declaration of war on you and mobilise an army and put myself through West Point, I may think better of it. Nevertheless, the truth is that people who deny that aggression plays any part in modern war just do not understand about the power of symbols. Indeed, it's my contention that when it comes to planning and prosecuting a war, the imaginal, symbolical manifestations of the war archetypes are primary. Wars don't begin beyond battlefields any more than they begin in senates, parliaments, or military headquarters. They begin in the minds of men. So battles, wars, blood feuds, conquests, and assassinations don't occur as spontaneous acts of furious aggression, but are accomplished beforehand in the imagination. And what is more, the planning, the anticipation, the achievement of victory in fantasy can occasion more excitement and more genuine fulfillment than the action. So people who say that there's no aggression in war forget that we humans can be just as violent in imagination as in reality. How marvellous it would be if all future wars would be confined to the imagination or to war games. But unfortunately, the fantasies that men find most rewarding are those which they intend to act out in reality. But that whole nations can be mobilized for war and become committed to total war for the whole of its duration is due to the power of symbols, and nobody understood this better than the late unlamented Dr. Goebbels. But I wouldn't wish to deny that policy decisions and rational planning at the governmental and military level do play their role in the genesis of wars. But successful prosecution of the war depends on mobilizing the corporate aggression of warriors. Recently, I asked in Britain one of our most eminent army officers, one of his most senior ones, a field marshal, a highly intelligent man, incidentally, who's written lots of books about the army and about the wars, and has fought a number of battles himself. I asked him whether he thought aggression played any part in modern war, and he replied that aggression was absolutely indispensable in the front-line soldier, and that if he lacked aggression, one's own side couldn't hope to win. An essential part of military training, he said, is to encourage aggression, to inculcate it, and to overcome inhibitions about using it. Now, I'll show you some video, which is about training young men for the British Parachute Regiment. And you'll be able to see in this that how important aggression seems to be. I apologize for the accents. The sergeant will say something quite incomprehensible. It says something like, and now we have the milling. And that means, and now we have the milling. And milling is a kind of, do you have that word? Do you use this word milling? It means boxing like that, frantically. Not, no science. You just hit as hard as you possibly can.
The first event this morning is the milling, the rough and tumble version of boxing, where opponents demonstrate their controlled aggression and will to win.
Is men prepared to knock hell out of their closest mates?
The sort of thing that we do not want to see is somebody whimpering, crying, turning his back to his opponent and refusing to fight.
Those judged insufficiently aggressive are simply made to fight twice. Loyalty to your team is the power's central article of faith. If teams don't exist, they create them.
Show me you can do it. Show me you can be adventurous.
The archetypal hypothesis holds that all primate males are born with innate biases to learn and develop aggressive patterns of behavior. Particular acts of aggression occur as a response to some environmental challenge. So it is that when men fight and kill, it is in response to a set of environmental circumstances which are perceived as demanding an aggressive reaction. But these environmental circumstances don't act on an unstructured organism. On the contrary, they act in such a way as to release aggressive behavior in an organism already equipped and primed to act aggressively when just such an eventuality should arise. And this equipment exists a priori as an archetypal system. It is, as Jung called it, an active living disposition, a vital component of the self. Well, I'm having to cut so many corners in order to get the essential argument across to you, but I'll go right away to just put to you, what are the archetypes of war? Well, I believe that human warlike behavior depends on structures within the brain and therefore within the psyche, which are interconnected and which mediate basic social behaviors and percepts. And broadly, I think these can be classified into three categories. In the first category, archetypes of this group determine the differentiation of outgroup from in-group, the projection of the shadow onto the outgroup, and the consequent perception of the outgroup as what Erik Erikson calls a pseudo-species. That is to say, that they belong to, they're not quite human, they're subhuman. The second category of archetypes determines aggressive warlike behavior, which is directed against the outgroup once pseudo-speciation has occurred, once the in-groups perceive the other as being less than human. Archetypes of this group mediate power-seeking, dominance-striving, maintenance of social hierarchies, and social cohesiveness within the in-group. They also determine the accordance of loyalty and obedience to the group leaders, and the formation of secure bonds, this is very important, between the males who collaborate for the purpose of aggression. Then the third group is concerned with aggression in the interests of group defense. Archetypes of this category operate in close conjunction with archetypes of the first two categories. And they are concerned with territoriality, they're concerned with attachment to the territory you see possessed by the in-group, and also they're concerned with vigilance in monitoring the behavior of potentially hostile outsiders and the perception of danger or threat. So these fundamental archetypal complexes exist a priori as accessible potential within the collective unconscious of the species. And they can be activated either individually or collectively by any environmental changes which are construed by individuals or their leaders as being a threat to the group or to its security or to its vital interests. And when that happens, the way is open to war. Now, in all probability, these archetypal systems are programmed to be released in sequence. And although it's true that different sequences may sometimes be found in the genesis of different conflicts, the procedure does seem to follow this pattern. And I've derived this from studying a number of conflicts, not just modern ones, but ancient ones, and also what the anthropologists say about primitive warfare. And this seems to apply to them all. First of all, attention is focused on an outgroup whose interests are perceived as being hostile to or in competition with the interests of one's in-group. Then there's a phase of negotiations. And during this, attempts are made to strengthen the interests of one's in-group at the expense of the out-group. And this is done through diplomatic channels. Then breakdown of these negotiations leads to an erosion of trust between both parties and the expression of hostile or threatening behavior on the part of one or both of them. Then expressions of mutual hostility coincide with a reinforcement of the perception by members of both groups that the other group constitutes a pseudo-species against which it would be legitimate to use organized group violence, resulting, if necessary, in death. Then, as the process of mutual denigration and mutual hostility progresses, the archetype of the enemy, Jung's shadow archetype, is constellated in members of both of each group and projected collectively onto the members of the other, so to get a cross-projection of the shadow. Now this shadow projection, this mutual shadow projection, coincides with the numinous phenomenon of archetypal possession, or what Lorenz calls militant enthusiasm. And as a result, aggressive feelings are mobilized and warlike preparations increase and obsess the male members of both communities. Then physical hostilities commence. The behavior of each group confirming the validity of the shadow projection by the other. There you are, we always knew they were like that. The physical hostilities persist and usually increase in ferocity until such time as it's perceived as being in the interests of one or both parties that these hostilities should cease. Then peace negotiations are instituted, which, if successful, result in the partial or virtually complete withdrawal of shadow projections and the resumption of diplomatic links. But this withdrawal of the mutual shadow projections can take a long, long time. It can take 40 years, as Mr. Reagan discovered only 2 weeks ago. Now, the crucial question for us to consider, I think, is, can our conscious awareness of the existence of these archetypal patterns enable us to become immune to their influence? You see, to succeed in so heroic a task would be to accomplish the ultimate work contra naturam, as Jung would have put it, against nature. Because the archetypes of war constitute an aspect of the self whose actualization we now have to do everything possible to prevent. Well, now, is this possible? And if so, how can it be done? I mean, can we change our biological nature? Can we alter the archetypes themselves? If not, is there some way in which the archetypes of group aggression can be inactivated or subjected to prolonged inhibition? Failing that, is there any means by which the archetypal propensity to warfare can find alternative outlets or substitute gratifications? And finally, is it possible that by a collective act of conscious will, humanity can band together and agree never again to respond actively to the archetypes of war? Well, let's look at the biological one first, because that does seem to be fairly primary. We could alter ourselves through genetic engineering. And it could be the only salvation of our problem. But the political and ethical implications of that are quite staggering. For example, what effect would the elimination of our capacity for aggression have on human creativity and human sexuality? And if the necessary biotechnology became available, who, for goodness sake, would take the political decision to use it? You see, the adoption of such a policy would be far more dramatic than unilateral nuclear disarmament, because you'd be eliminating from human nature the very stuff that makes tough soldiers. Well, the probability is that the archetypes themselves wouldn't let it happen. They would ensure that the population collectively conceived any government determined to implement such a policy as bent on suicide, and they would remove them from power. Only if a global dictator ordered the removal of aggressive potential from the entire population of the world might such a course be practical, but then, even then, he would doubtless make an exception in the case of his own bodyguard. I mean, how else could he carry out his will? So this means, really and truly, that from now on we shall have to live in a world under constant threat of annihilation. And hope can only lie in the clarity with which we perceive that threat and the determination that we exert collectively to thwart its realization. So if the archetypes as such can't be changed, I think we could turn that off just for a moment, thanks very much. If they can't be changed, can something to be done to discourage their activation? Well, there is good reason to suppose that it can. You see, in theory, it should be quite easy. All one has to do is reverse the usual procedures which governments use for mobilizing the archetypes of war. You see, instead of preparing boys for war, we should educate them for peace. Instead of preparing, instead of distributing the symbols of war, we should celebrate the symbols of peace. In place of warmongering propaganda, we should encourage peace-loving art. And instead of tolerating exclusive male groups dedicated to violence, we should insist on opening up all groups to feminine influences. And instead of stimulating hypothalamic excitement, we should do everything possible to sustain cerebral control. But it all sounds very easy, but it's much more difficult in practice. There is, for example, a long and honorable tradition of anti-war art, which goes back at least as far as classical times. This is a bronze votive plaque from ancient Argos, showing the donor on his war horse, and it bears the heartfelt inscription, "A curse upon Enyalios, god of war." And here is Henry Glintenkamp's famous cartoon of death measuring a young recruit like a tailor, not for his smart new uniform, but for his coffin. Incidentally, Glintenkamp was indicted for this in 1917 under the US Espionage Act, and he had to flee to Mexico. I'm glad to say he made it. Now, whereas governments use graphics to encourage young men to enlist, art can also be used to discourage them. Steve Horn's poster for the Committee to End the War in Vietnam is a brilliant reversal of the recruiting poster used to such devastating effect in the First World War, where Uncle Sam pointed directly at the observer and said, "I want you." Much anti-recruitment propaganda presented the volunteer not so much as a hero as a brainless idiot, or at best a victim whose capacity to think what he was doing with his life would be readily excised or removed by military training. This is Robert Miner's cartoon showing a recruit with a magnificent physique but no head, and the medical examiner is saying, "At last, a perfect soldier." Now, these illustrations come from a marvelous book called Art Against War by Bruckner, Fast and Heller, which was published last year. And all these pictures in their book demonstrate that deep compassion and enormous artistic ingenuity has gone into the symbolic battle to inhibit activation of the archetypes of war. Who can say how much good they may have done? But one thing is certain, alas, they have not stopped war. Well, what about male prerogatives of power and the use of armed force? Could these be altered by political means? Since all male associations are rigorous about the exclusion of women, what would happen if such associations were compelled to admit women by law? I mean, this might be done, for example, much in the same way as the Indian government decreed that untouchables be given a proportion of seats in all legislatures and granted special privileges by the Indian government designed to redress in all the discrimination they had suffered throughout history. Now, perhaps women could be guaranteed a proportion of places not only in legislatures, but also in the decision-making bodies dealing with finance, defense, and war. Unfortunately, we can have little idea what effect deliberate efforts to thwart the archetypal pattern might have, even if men were willing to tolerate it and collaborate in their implementation. And it's also unlikely that Western governments would be prepared to introduce the necessary legislation unless Eastern counterparts expressed a willingness to do the same. But it would add an interesting dimension to discussions of détente. So, I think we can turn that off now. If we can't eliminate the archetypes of war or completely inhibit their expression, can we displace their activity into less destructive modes of behavior? You see, thus far in the history of our species, war has provided the invariable alternative to peace. But why, one wonders, do people need alternatives to peace? I mean, what is wrong with peace? Well, one answer is that men, particularly young men, find it boring. They crave excitement, commitment, achievement, success. So if war is to be an alternative to peace, then we, in our perilous circumstances, need to find alternatives to war. And clearly, if it's to prove viable, any alternative we propose must guarantee a fair measure of excitement in the participants. Well, what alternative excitements are there to war? Horror films? Video nasties? Dangerous sports? I was watching somebody play some baseball the other day. I mean, gosh, I'm very glad I grew up in a country where they played cricket. I've never seen such a dangerous game in all my life. Motorbike and car racing, boxing, hand gliding, mountaineering, solitary yachting, competitive sports like soccer and the hooliganism that often follows them, especially in Britain, crime, vandalism, sex, drugs, alcohol, gambling, all are exciting to some degree. But excitement, like patriotism, is not enough. We know from the cross-cultural studies of a brilliant anthropologist called Lionel Tiger that no warlike alternative will satisfy young men unless it fulfills their archetypal longing to bond with one another in a form of aggressive action that will bring them self-validation and esteem. Now, in primitive cultures, these needs are not necessarily satisfied in wars. They're often fulfilled in ritualized wars. And these are evidently designed to diminish the chances that combatants will kill or seriously injure one another. And, for example, the Yonomami Indians have a ritualized combat. They shave off their heads and they whack one another over the cranium with long poles. This seems to satisfy their warlike intentions. Some Australian tribes, like the Walbiri, throw spears at one another, but they're very careful to aim at their legs. Now, we conduct similar rituals under the guise of organized games and sports. But unfortunately, sport cannot provide us with a reliable, dependable substitute for war. And the reason is quite simply that ritualized combat functions as an effective substitute only as long as both parties know and respect the rules and provided there is a certain bond between them. If the bond is severed, then pseudo-speciation and shadow projection occurs, the ritual is abandoned, and the killing begins. The idea of war as a game is still very prevalent in our culture, and the entertainment industry, of course, capitalizes on this. And the many popular forms of science fiction are dominated by the bloody tumult of interplanetary conflict, interstellar wars, rebellions against galactic tyrants, and struggles to the death between the forces of good and evil, and so on. Such productions not only illustrate the powerful influence of on our imagination of the archetypes of war, but they also provide a relatively harmless outlet for their expression. But when one considers the relative merits of sport and fiction, sport would seem to fulfill more archetypal needs. Male bonding, team spirit, violent physical exertion, struggle against opposing force, danger, masculine validation, victory, and esteem. The problem is, as we've already noted, that games fail as... That was Samson and Delilah. I was going to call that my plan for influencing male war combat by female, Operation Delilah. But the problem about games is that they fail as substitutes for war when pseudo-speciation occurs between opponents who, as a consequence, refuse to play. Then it turns into war, even on the pitch. So, is there no ritualized combat or conflict that can be enjoyed by teams which are deeply hostile to one another, and which will continue even when pseudo-speciation has occurred. Well, I think there is one, and it's called the arms race. Now, in the 60s, we also had the space race, but now, of course, we have the arms race and the space race combined in the new game called Star Wars, or The High Frontier. Now, the interesting thing is that as early as 1963, a man called Arthur Vaskoff predicted something very, very perceptive and, as we now discover, true. He said that the nuclear stalemate, which had already got established between the East and the West in the late 50s, would inevitably lead to the development of substitutes for traditional war in relations between the two blocs. He foresaw, you see, the use of competitive bribery in the form of economic and military aid. And he saw the use of guerrilla tactics against hostile governments and the development of commando tactics for the support of friendly ones. He saw all these as substitutes for the real thing. All these, he argued, were, together with the arms race and the space race, new techniques for carrying coercive pressures to the enemy without actually fighting him. And we could add to this list, of course, the espionage and the counter-espionage and the dirty tricks departments of the CIA and the KGB, and the use of economic sanctions and corn embargoes, the maintenance of psychological pressure through propaganda on the radio, and also at the United Nations Organization, and so on. But the arms race has become, in our time, the war substitute par excellence. And there's some indication that this is becoming a war of attrition. That you see, the economic cost of staying in the race is so enormous that the weaker economy could crumble under the strain. And then the stronger side would win by default without any one of these ruinously expensive missiles actually being fired. So you see, in this sense, the East-West conflict has become reminiscent of a sort of potlatch ceremony, in which a man demonstrates his superiority by conspicuously destroying his wealth. Of course, I might have known that in Seattle and in the Northwest you would appreciate this comment. It was rather wasted on the New Yorkers, I may say. The arms race is, of course, part of the larger game in which East and West are engaged, which we might call lethal poker or anti-Russian roulette. This is a ruinous, terrifying game of bluff, which goes under the official and wholly appropriate name of MAD, mutually assured destruction. And it works on the principle, of course, that people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And up to the present, it has worked. But does this mean that it will work forever? By inventing this new game, the international game of nuclear chicken, have we found a permanent substitute for war? Or are we like the man who jumped off the top of the Empire State Building and as he passed the fifth floor was heard to mutter, "So far, so good." The terrifying danger which we all face is that one day one side will miscalculate and call the other side's bluff at a moment when the other side believes it cannot allow its bluff to be called. This could have happened, of course, over Cuba, had President Kennedy and Khrushchev been made of different stuff, and it could, of course, have happened over Afghanistan. But fortunately, both sides appear to acknowledge the potentially lethal consequences of playing this game, and as a result, neither side, thank goodness, is in the habit of threatening nuclear holocaust in order to achieve its political ambitions. So, provided there is no catastrophic miscalculation on the part of our leaders, it looks as if the mad game is here to stay. Frightening though it may be, it is the best substitute for war that we have. Well, as Jungians, we shouldn't forget that just as everything positive has its shadow, so all that is negative has its positive antithesis. We must therefore examine the possibility that even something as patently evil and destructive as the nuclear weapon may make a good and creative contribution to our lives. Well, what could that be? Well, in the first place, the terrible threat which the nuclear weapon poses to our species is making us think, not only about each international incident, but about the nature of war itself and how it might be prevented. Secondly, the terror of the consequences of unleashing nuclear conflict may be the only incentive powerful enough to force us to abandon war as an extension of policy by other means. The purpose of war, you see, is to gain the spoils of victory, and nuclear weapons now prohibit the attainment of this goal. Neither side can hope to be the winner. Both sides would be the losers. So for the first time in history, thanks to nuclear weapons, war has ceased to be a rational option. So the bomb is our opportunity to abolish war. The third value of nuclear weapons, which we should not underrate, is the fear that they induce in leaders as well as the led. While our leaders might, it's true, in the fastness of their bunkers, survive an initial nuclear exchange, their chances of survival in the nuclear winter that followed would be no better than for the rest of us. And so, for the first time in history, war has become suicidal for everyone, the organizers as well as the organized. Finally, as we've noted, the existence of nuclear weapons serves to guarantee the perpetuation of the Cold War as a substitute for a war which would be undeniably hot. The Cold War has its virtues. It goes a long way to satisfy the archetypal need for in-group, out-group confrontation while preventing it from getting out of hand. So, when condemning nuclear weapons, we shouldn't forget that their existence has ensured peace since 1945, at least in the main theatre of confrontation between the East and West, namely Europe. And this, for anybody familiar with European history, is a phenomenal achievement. Sensitively managed, you see, the nuclear stalemate could continue to guarantee this welcome and unprecedented peace, provided the archetypal imperatives to war do not possess a blind tidal dynamic all their own. But if the Cold War is to remain chilly and not get too warm for comfort, it is essential that no powerfully influential group on either side should be able to conceive of war as an acceptable means of attaining their political objectives. Provided both parties persist in viewing armed conflict as intolerable, there is reason to hope that the hostility between the East and the West will continue to find expression through channels other than war. The only factor that could upset this would be a radical shift in the balance of power. This might occur either as a result of a major technological breakthrough by one party which gave it overwhelming superiority by, for example, making its territory invulnerable to attack, which is the policy of Star Wars, or it could occur as a result of one side adopting a policy of unilateral nuclear disarmament. Bilateral nuclear disarmament is, of course, a very different thing. But even if it were politically feasible, it would prove a mixed blessing, because it would remove the one factor effectively inhibiting the archetypes of war, namely fear. Were it ever achieved, nuclear disarmament would create an international climate in which it would again become possible for politicians to use war as an extension of policy by other means, and worst of all, to conceive of themselves, the wretches, as winning and surviving it. So in any case, the notion that we can ever again live in a nuclear-free world has all the realism of a psychedelic dream. However many agreements the negotiators sign and legislators ratify, we shall never be able to scrap nuclear weapons entirely. Knowledge of how to make and deliver them is embedded in our culture and will be available as long as our culture survives. The only way to scrap nuclear weapons would be to round up the world's nuclear physicists and shoot them. And then also, in addition, to follow up by destroying every physical science library, every textbook, every encyclopedia, and every science laboratory in the world. Even then, some bright boy would have a Xerox copy of the relevant data in a box under his bed. There are some clocks that you just cannot put back. So nuclear disarmament would have the twin disadvantages of making conventional war more likely without being able to guarantee that it would not turn nuclear. Conventional world war is, alas, always a possibility, but it's less likely to start, and if it starts, less likely to become nuclear if both sides retain the capacity to annihilate one another. There's a brilliant paper on possible substitutes for war by Dr. Anthony Storr, and in this paper he says that in our efforts to realize our full potential, struggle and opposition are absolutely necessary. He says, if enemies do not exist, we promptly invent them, as anyone who has served on a committee must know. Very true that. Our mistake is to think that anything is achieved by destroying our enemies. On the contrary, he says, we ought to struggle to preserve them. So whatever action we take, the East and the West will remain in conflict for the foreseeable future. And it's important that the nuclear stalemate should not stultify this conflict. For the health of both sides, it should remain dynamic without spilling over into violence. But the status quo must be respected. You see, the majority of proposals for the abolition of war are unhelpful because of their psychological naivety. They envisage a utopian state of affairs in which men would be content to live in permanent peace with one another. They imagine that conflict can actually be dispensed with and that we should all feel better without it. I wouldn't deny that the peace movement and the unilateral disarmers perform a useful function because they irritate the politicians. They disrupt their complacency, and they provoke them at least to consider the possibility of coming to an enlightened accommodation with the East and stopping this ludicrous escalation which is going on all the time. But anybody who expects the two superpowers to live in disarmed amity has rather a limited understanding of archetypal reality. So many conflicts of interest and philosophy exist.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Ewing Society, Seattle. And the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.